From WXXI News, this is 1370 Connection. Good afternoon and welcome to the first hour of the show. I'm Lashay Agnew joining you today along with Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, and WRVO Innovation Trail reporter Ryan Delaney. It is Innovation Friday. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello. Thanks, Lashay. Thanks for having us again. And it's the first hour we're really going to spend looking at a series that we've been running all this week across Upstate Public Radio, including with WXXI.
And it is a great series.
Been a really interesting series. And Ryan's done a lot of the heavy lifting on that, as well as our WXXI reporter Kate O'Connell and WBFO's Ashley Hertzel. They've been looking at the refugee community in upstate New York. Now, it was news to me when I started looking at the series that, in fact, upstate New York takes 90% of all of the refugees that are settled in New York State. This is something that started around 2004. Instead of putting people into the five boroughs area, they started to push people upstate into cities that had some infrastructure to support their resettlement. So people would be really aware that towns like Utica and Syracuse have had a very, very significant input from those new arrivals. So here's a few statistics just to get our head around the issue.
Okay.
So for the financial year 2012, there were about 58,000 projected refugee arrivals. I think there were slightly less that actually ended up making it into the States. Of that number, New York State took a little over 3,500 of that amount, but 90% of those came to upstate. So the top three counties are Erie County, Monroe County, Onondaga County, in that order. So they're the three areas. So it's a really significant kind of engine of social development, social change, community development, and that's what we really wanted to get into with this particular series. So Ryan, just asking you, you went over to Utica. Just tell us why Utica was a kind of an important sort of pit stop when we started developing the storyline for this.
Because even though Utica hasn't necessarily taken in the highest number of refugees in the past decade or so, the refugees that they have taken in has probably had the biggest impact on that city. They've resettled in the past three decades or so about 15,000 refugees. And Utica, New York, is a city whose population has dropped to about 60,000. So refugees make up almost a quarter of that city's population. And it's really a major source of the population of new people coming to that city.
It's how the city's kind of staying afloat. Yeah, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Let's have a listen to your report. We're going to have a listen right now.
Utica has long seen itself as a city of immigrants. The arrival of Italians, Germans, and Irish saw the city's population peak at around 100,000. Hard times fell on the city in the 1970s, but waves of refugees from Bosnia, Burma, Bhutan, and Somalia have stabilized the population. It's now a little over 60,000. Refugees and new immigrants make up a quarter of that.
The city that we have now was an economic boom until about the 70s, and these new refugees really, really rebuilt the city.
Joe Marino is a city councilor. He's given me a tour of his district to point out how the refugee population has turned whole neighborhoods around. Four out of five longtime Utica residents want to see more refugees settle here, according to a recent survey of the region. That's likely because there are visible signs of their positive impact, as Marino was pointing out. Many refugee families, especially from Bosnia, have begun to re-inhabit once run-down neighborhoods, and new businesses have opened downtown. We stop at a section of public housing and quickly find Stepanda Zhushma working a community garden.
Red beets, this garlic or lettuce.
Zhushma came to the United States on September 23rd, 1989, from Belarus. The date rolls off her tongue. She and some other petite women tend the tomatoes and cucumbers, and visitors never leave empty-handed. Nearby, brightly colored African fabrics dry in the line outside a home, a sign of the newer wave of residents.
Good, I'm just visiting. How are you?
Shelly Callahan is making her rounds through the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees, a nonprofit which handles resettlements for all refugees in the Utica area. They help with job placement, putting kids in school, and English language classes, like this one, where they're learning to tell time.
Quarter 2-4.
15,000 refugees have come through the center in the past three decades. They're the main source of new and young people in a city that's otherwise seen residents leave.
Hi, oh my goodness, how are you?
I sat down with several women who now call Utica home and work as professional translators. Alla Moisiuk arrived from the Ukraine when she was just a toddler.
In Utica, it's kind of like everyone from all over the world, and that's, you know, it's kind of like this huge, huge family. And everyone, most of the refugees, they I think they care for each other.
Sulian from Taiwan says she's reminded of her country of origin whenever she ventures out of Utica's welcoming confines.
Most of the time, I don't remember I'm different. Most of the time, I don't really care my accent, but there are certain places that kind of remind me of that.
A study by Hamilton College found that while most require help from several social welfare programs at first, refugees have a positive economic impact. It takes about 6 years, but soon those families are paying income and sales tax and buying homes. They're also providing services to newer refugee arrivals.
Next week, was it Keisha?
You speak good Swahili.
Abdullahi Majeni and Jelani Samboga run the Mohawk Valley Somali Bantu Community Association. For them, keeping the association running and paying the rent on their building is a constant challenge. But they have a mission, Majeni says, to make sure the newer Somali Bantus coming to Utica find a helping hand, something they didn't necessarily always have.
We are patients. We're here for them. Just if we did not do that, who's going to help them? We are ahead of them. We are the one who knows how to read and write. We have to guide them to be our future generation. Just if we did not guide them, then who's going to guide them?
Later this week, we'll travel to Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse to see the impact of the refugee community on those cities.
And that report from Ryan Delaney, who's in the studio with us now.
Great
and
report, Ryan.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, really nice, vivid sort of snapshot of these voices, the diverse community there. But it's, I think, one of the things, sort of some background that we came across while we were researching the series was really an analysis. You referred to this, a couple of studies that have been done where they've really tried to put some hard data or an economic information around what the refugee resettlement policies have meant. And in particular, one of the things that was interesting about the most recent research is it's actually been done with a view to enabling the Mohawk Valley Refugee Resource
Resource Center for Refugees
to actually provide consultancy and information to other communities that are looking to integrate refugees. So it's sort of that's a really interesting kind of sense of possibility too for another kind of economic outcome from providing those sorts of services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Resource Center was really just an incredible place to visit and to walk around. Just the amount of work and how hard they work, and just the activity that's going on there every day. They do fantastic work, and that's part of one of the big reasons why so many refugees have ended up in Utica. The State Department looks to places like the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees or Catholic Charities and Interfaith Works, which are the two organizations in Syracuse. The refugees who we should point out, most refugees on average spend 17 years in a refugee camp before they're resettled.
Oh, wow.
They do get some say in what country they come to, but not what city, unless... In the case of if there's family, they might end up in the same city where they have family already. But for the most part, they're placed here. So the State Department really leans on these folks on the ground, these resource centers and charities to resettle these refugees. And the federal government gives them about $1,800 for rent and food for their first couple of weeks. And then they're basically on their own without these groups to help them.
So we're going to actually talk to another representative of one of the resource centres. So I'm going to head over to Erie County and speak with Jeff Ogilvie. Jeff works with Journey's End. Journey's End is a refugee resource centre based in Buffalo, New York. Jeff, welcome to Innovation Friday.
Thank you, Matthew.
Great to have you with us. Thanks. Just tell us your particular area that you work at Journey's End. You're involved in particularly on sort of job development and work placement. Is that right?
That's correct. Officially, my title is Employment Services Coordinator, but what we run under our program is employment and training programs, vocational training programs specifically.
Right, and we mentioned earlier in the introduction, Erie County does take the largest proportion of resettlements in upstate. How did that sort of come about? Do you know? Is it just because of the existing resources that Buffalo had, the infrastructure that Buffalo had in place?
That's correct. I think a big part of it is the existing communities that exist here. So families that want to come from their refugee camp, can apply in some manner to choose where they have family or family ties.
Right. So tell us a little bit about, we're going to hear a report from our Innovation Trail reporter, Ashley Herzl, who spent some time with Journey's End, and hear a particular story around a particular refugee story. But tell us a little bit about what kind of programs and priorities Journey's End kind of puts in place.
Sure. I mean, we do everything from A to Z. We're a resettlement agency to start off with, but we go from there to transitioning after the resettlement period clients to our employment program. And that really includes the state grants that we have allow us to provide services to the refugees for up to 5 years. And the services that we're able to provide essentially are the same as all the case management services provided in their initial resettlement period.
Yep.
So from there, we're helping them find jobs, get the education that they're asking for, navigate, our system to get those services.
Right. And tell us a little bit about what are the sort of work areas that you guys have been focusing on in terms of potential job placement for the refugees you've been trying to place?
Sure. Hospitality industry has been, I think, across the country, a very traditional place for refugees to begin entry-level positions. We've been very successful with that in the Buffalo area. But we've also expanded our focus onto other areas like light industrial manufacturing, machine operation, delivery drivers, delivery companies, and the traditional, again, janitorial, maintenance, and sewing industries.
Right.
Jeff, it's Ryan Delaney. If you could talk a little bit about the challenges that you face in placing refugees in jobs, because there aren't as many of the blue-collar manufacturing jobs, the steel mills, where immigrants 40, 50 years ago could start working and really earn a good living without necessarily the English language skills. A lot of the manufacturing jobs that are still here in upstate New York require more English and a higher level of education to be able to do.
Right. It is tricky. That is one of our two biggest challenges with placing individuals is the language barrier and transportation to get to the job sites. We've created a model that we're able to, work with the employer to identify kind of a leadership person or people that to place into companies first that have a little better command of the English language, and then we plant them into the jobs, get them trained and up to speed, and then it allows us to bring in some lower level English speakers to work alongside them. And we found a lot of success with that.
So things like, just an issue like transport, which I guess a lot of people would take for granted in a car culture of Western New York. What sort of strategies do you come up with just to sort of resolve things like that?
There's not much way to get around the bus system. I mean, we definitely, attend NFTA meetings to represent the community and their needs for public transportation. The refugees are a tight community, whether you're from Burma or the Congo. So when we're able to place, more than one person at a location, they're very willing to help each other out. So carpooling, we identify people with personal transportation, and they really come close and work together.
Right. Are you seeing, also seeing, I think we did a story, Ashley Herzl did a story for us about, I think, a Nepali couple who set up a sort of a support agency to help community members with, you know, with some of the same issues you're talking about. So are you also seeing, I guess, empowerment or kind of spin-offs where community members also are coming up, stepping up to sort of provide services and support, you know, in their own way?
Right, right. I've heard this more than once that when refugees come to the city, they're no longer like a refugee from one specific country. They're just a refugee trying to earn the American dream. So they're very willing to help each other out, from no matter where you are. That's the biggest strength in that.
Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, how you interconnect with other support agencies and, I guess, the state, you know, the New York State system that provides resources for refugee resettlement and also to the level of, say, the U.S., the federal sort of refugee administrations? What sort of dialogues sort of occur between those sort of layers of government?
Honestly, I don't know how much I can comment on the government relationship. I mean, within the city, there are four resettlement agencies. We definitely work together in the resettlement area. And then when it comes to, the employment programs, we all have our grants, whether they're from the state or directly to the federal government. So we all kind of work a little bit independently, of course, encouraging the same message to the community and employers.
Great. So what sort of contributions or discussions are underway with the business community? Do you have sort of regular occasions where you get to come together and talk about, I guess their demand? I mean, we hear a lot about the sort of the gap between education and, say, areas like Ryan mentioned the manufacturing sector, where there's sort of a little bit of a mismatch between skills and so on. And we're also seeing, obviously, younger generations of people from, refugee communities coming through and entering education. Is that sort of having, are you sort of seeing some changes in that way?
We are seeing some changes, but it's slow. There's definitely the education gap, and it starts anywhere from, the older teenagers that arrive, and that seems to be a big focus right now in Erie County is the group that's coming in that have some decent language skills and some education, but based on the requirements of the state, they really don't have, they're not set up to graduate by the time they're required to be out of school. So there is an alternative program called the MAC program, where we're providing a space for these young folks to come and either learn English or prepare for their GED exam to get them into college and on the professional path.
Great. Well, just stay with us, Jeff. We're just going to have a listen to the story that Ashley Herzl did working, spent some time with Journey's End. And she tells the story of a Bhutanese refugee who's now working with Journey's End and helping local people from the refugee community get ready for the job market in Buffalo. Here's her report.
How we can use this platform, okay?
A handful of students from countries all over the world are sitting in a class at Journey's End Refugee Services. Today, they're learning how to become janitors for local businesses. The group nods as another student explains an assignment to them.
This one is the electrical materials, okay? Before using this, we have to check whether the vacuum is good or not.
It wasn't that long ago that their teacher, Bishnu Adhikari, was sitting in their seat trying to understand English and the concept of a mop bucket and vacuum. Adhikari and his wife, Chitra, came to the United States in 1992. They spent 17 years in a refugee camp in Nepal before arriving in the U.S.
We were thinking buffalo means an animal. Buffalo, that's what we heard.
Erie County services the most refugee arrivals in New York State. In 2012, the city of Buffalo assisted over 1,000, most of who were from Bhutan, like Adhikari.
When I came to Buffalo Airport, I found my case manager. We shook hands, but I was unknown. Who is this boy? What he is asking for? But he called my name and said, I am your case manager.
When Adhikari and his wife Chitra arrived at their new apartment, there were many things inside the home they'd never seen before, like the stove.
He showed us how to use gas stove. Gas stove, it was very new for us because we were using firewood to cook. We don't know how to turn on, how to use it.
Adhikari and Chitra also didn't eat for a few days.
We didn't find our food for a couple of days. After some days, we saw the grocery store. We went there and bought, and she started to cook.
After he settled into his new apartment, Adhikari enrolled in classes at Journeys End Refugee Services to learn English. Today, he's working as a vocational trainer and employment specialist. Adhikari says he talks to his students solely in English.
They have no way to move back to their country where they use their language. They need to use English properly because this is their country now.
And he says his students are learning more than how to be a housekeeper or janitor.
They are also learning new things. For example, how to sit for the interview and what are the new challenges they are going to face. And also how to call 911 if something happens on the way to their workplace.
Every year, Journeys End places more than 300 refugees in sectors like food service, hospitality, and manufacturing. Brianna DeFonso is a volunteer manager with the agency. She says refugees are a crucial part of the local business community.
Because for them, it's more than a job. It's the chance to actually be able to provide for their family again, which they may not have been able to do for the last several decades.
More importantly, DeFonso says refugees are also bringing a new wave of energy to a city whose population has declined.
They'll be the people who are taking the initiative, who are opening the businesses, who are founding cultural organizations, who are making the schools better. They're there. They're willing to work on it, and they want to see their new city succeed.
DeFonso says in order for refugees to succeed in making a better Buffalo, they need the help of the community.
So if you're behind someone in line at the grocery store and they're having trouble counting the change, instead of being frustrated and upset, you could be supportive and calm and either help them or just wait until they're done. That's going to be huge.
And Bishnu Adhikari says if longtime residents and refugees work together, the city will be a force to reckon with.
And that report from Ashley Hertzler, WBFO, Innovation Trail reporting partner, and with me as well is Ryan Delaney from WRVO. And Jeff, you're with us, Jeff Ogilvy from Journeys End. That was the agency that Ashley was reporting from in that story, and a really nice sort of case study about Bishnu's journey from refugee camp through the resettlement process and now actually, you know, obviously an active mentor for other new arrivals who are coming to Buffalo, Jeff.
Yeah, absolutely. We are extremely lucky to have him part of our team. I don't know who's a bigger resource for who, whether we're a bigger resource for him or he helps us more from a cultural perspective,
right,
understanding the needs and desires and dreams of the Bhutanese community.
And is that kind of, I guess, part of the aspiration of Journeys End is obviously to get more people like Bishnu into those, positions where they're mentoring newer community members?
Absolutely. It's a big focus that we have. Bishnu's value is just not measurable. He's a huge help.
Just wanted to touch on something when we were getting prepped to have you on the program. We just touched on this issue of some of the particular challenges for people in the sort of 18 to 25 year range in terms of job placement. I mean, we know that this is a challenge that, you know, all upstate New York people in that age range are kind of facing some really strong challenges at the moment. What's your thought around what kind of challenge that's going to present for you and for the community you serve?
Well, it's probably close to the same challenges that any other teenager or you know, person in their early 20s have getting a job. You know, what's available to you is maybe on the more seasonal part-time track, and that's actually okay with us. We're really pushing education as first and foremost as our recommendation to them.
Right, and in terms of how you think you're going to have to readjust this, your kind of way of operating is, are you seeing that you need to sort of realign some of the ways that you're going to provide services going forward?
It actually falls right into what we do. I mean, we you know, in job development, we see jobs, you know, come in weekly that can be part-time or full-time. But we really try to run a person-centered program. So part of our, not only our state contract, but our mission and philosophy here is to, you know, work with each individual and their individual goals. So it's really, you know, depends on the person and what they're telling us they want. And then we make recommendations based on that.
Great. Jeff Ogilvie, thanks very much. Jess from Journey's End, which is a refugee resource centre in Buffalo, New York. Thanks very much for being on Innovation Friday today, Jeff.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. Take care.
Thank you. So we're going to take you to another part of the state now. Ryan, you want to set this story up? This is a story that you did quite a bit of legwork for based around the particular neighborhood in Syracuse.
Yes, I spent some time on the north side of Syracuse. It's a neighborhood that in a lot of ways has always been the immigrant neighborhood of Syracuse. For a long time, it was the big Italian section, the Little Italy of Syracuse. And what's incredible about this neighborhood now is there is still some of that footprint from the Italians there. There's still some fantastic Italian restaurants and 100-plus-year-old bakeries. And, you know, it's a place where you can walk down the same block and get fantastic biscotti and a cappuccino and, you know, then walk into the African International Restaurant and get, you know, some great ugali, which is a corn dish from, you know, parts of East Africa. And it's an amazing mix of, you know, that Italian heritage and also Germans and Irish and, you know, other parts of the north side of Syracuse and, you know, African influence and Asian markets. And it's a very hard working class part of the city that has its, you know, fair share of struggles that the rest of upstate New York cities have with vacancy and poverty. But there's some people that really love that neighborhood for a lot of very good reasons.
Okay, let's have a listen to your report.
So, welcome to tonight.
Welcome to 129 Lilac Street. Every Tuesday evening, this home turns into a community center. It's snowing for the first time, and Nicole Watts says turnout may be a little low. Watts runs a group called Hope Print. After living in the suburbs, she and some others have basically embedded themselves on Syracuse's north side by buying two houses on this block. That's allowed them to follow the ups and downs of the ethnically diverse neighborhood pretty closely.
We can share in that struggle or share in that opportunity versus them sharing it and us attempting to understand from a distance.
Sit with us.
It's an hour later, and now every corner of Watts' home is full of refugees and some of the neighborhood's long-term residents. The youngest scribble with crayons, and in the living room, the adults are practicing English. Agnes Ayombe lives in the house. Born in the war-torn Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, she came to Syracuse 3 years ago with some younger siblings and a son. The others all live in foster care, but Ayombe found a welcome home on Lilac Street.
Here, I'm African in the midst of our white people. So trying to build that relationship as a person, not just the language, just like, you know, because when you have a relationship with somebody, even if you don't speak the same language, they are more patient and willing to understand and help.
That's a situation Lorena Mpinga knows all too well. She was a teenager when she also arrived from the DRC, not knowing English. She was bullied her first year in high school.
I have to make sure I let them know who I am. I'm not just like this little scared girl. No. And I don't want to live a life of being scared of going to school.
Despite the rocky start, Mpinka says it didn't damper her move to Syracuse. In the past decade, more than 7,200 refugees have found new homes here, according to the State Department. City officials recognize the importance of this new population and have been focusing on investing in the neighborhood. But it's still a working-class area that has its share of crime and vacancy. Michael Collins oversees housing efforts for Interfaith Works Center for New Americans, one of the two charities in Syracuse that resettle refugees. He says that infusion is improving the North Side's real estate.
We've seen the people choosing to invest in the housing on the North Side, rather than as there's more flight out of the city, as we've seen for many, many years now. What we're finding is that we've got active investors that are buying up properties that otherwise might go vacant.
So that's the good news. But the factory jobs that used to be open to immigrants with no English are all but gone.
Easy.
There are job training programs run through nonprofits, like this one in Green Construction. But finding refugees good jobs en masse is a challenge, says Susan Olson from Interfaith Works.
There are no places like GE anymore. There are no places where there are those big organizations where you could move up doing a manual labor type job. All you need is training, basically.
Olson says refugees are finding work. Agriculture is a good source of employment, and she says some high-tech manufacturers are seeking out refugees to fill their ranks once they've built up the language skills.
Okay, so don't go through that.
Back at 129 Lilac Street, the girls are threading yarn through metal washers to make crafts. Agnes Ayombe is in the kitchen doing the dishes. While this home has been a place of fitting in, she says there have been times in the past few years that she's felt terribly out of place.
It's hard, stressful. It can bring anxiety and depression, everything, because, you know, now I've made this step, so let me look forward to my life in 5 years. But instead of that, you start, like, looking to your life back, because you have to start, like, learning what you could have done.
Ayombe says she may never feel fully settled in Syracuse, but it's getting better.
And Ryan Delaney was reporting. And Ryan, yeah, that was a really remarkable story. I mean, not sure if people picked up at the very beginning of that this is essentially a residence that's been set up on this particular street in the North Side that also sort of converts.
Has a very open door policy.
Right. So it sort of functions as a community centre. Yeah. Really interesting. You're with a 1370 Connection on WXXI Public Radio. We're going to take a short break and then we'll be back with more from our refugee resettlement series. And thanks for joining us again on 1370 Connection on WXXI, your public radio station. With me in the studio, Ryan Delaney from WRVO. And also with us is Adnan Hirad. Adnan is currently at the University of Rochester. Welcome to the program, Adnan. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your... your origins are in Somalia, your family origins?
Yes.
Right. Just tell us a little bit about your journey, because you're like a relative in your arrival to Rochester, but you've also spent time elsewhere in New York State and Pennsylvania.
Right. So I was born in Somalia. I spent the first 14 years there, in the northern part of the country. And then I went to high school in Sudan, lived there until 2003, and then had to again move to South Africa. And I think that's a journey and a story I share with a lot of other refugees and immigrants moving from one country to another.
Right.
I came here in 2005. I came to New York City in 2005 Went to college there, and then was in Philadelphia also for about 2 years doing part of a master's in research at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And I came here in 2011 to join the MD-PhD program at the U of R.
So MD-PhD, and just tell us a little bit about your particular area of interest in your PhD research.
My PhD research is basically focused on figuring out how the environment that a cell is in affects the behavior of that cell. And so research has traditionally been focused on what a cell does on its own and how then it impacts its environment. And so the environment has been looked at as this sort of passive milieu that a cell sits in and has no say in what a cell does. And recently, people have been finding that that's not true. And so we're focused on studying that particular aspect of biology and then seeing where we can focus on and then how that affects cancer and behaviors that sort of induce disease.
Right. And you're also doing a conventional medical degree alongside
right,
all this stuff. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, very intimidating. Yeah. So we've been talking a lot in this series. We've been sort of looking, I guess, at we've been trying to get a sense of this. There's this kind of policy or kind of a decision that's been made to resettle refugee communities in upstate New York for various kinds of reasons. So, what's your sort of perception, I guess, as someone who's travelled and now is in Rochester, of the way that those communities have kind of contributed and are contributing to the communities that they're being placed with?
Right. So it's really the thing that's really great about America is that once you come in, your status as a refugee or immigrant basically drops off and everyone considers you as just part of the community. And so people don't ask you where you're from. They assume you're from somewhere in the country. And the opportunities that are available to those new immigrants are equal to the citizens of this country. And so in that regard, the resettlement programs are fantastic and they work and obviously a lot better than wherever most of all of us are coming from. The one thing, though, that can sort of, although these opportunities are available, I think to a new immigrant, a family that does not know the lay of the land when it comes to education or healthcare or all the other services that they require, it can be intimidating. It can be very hard to figure out and confusing. And so there are a lot of challenges that can be associated with that sort of lack of knowledge about the process.
Right.
If you could talk a little bit about higher education. You mentioned right before we were on air that you were fortunate enough to get a scholarship for all this great research and med schooling that you're doing. But you talk a little bit about, you've been here for a few years, trying to adjust and get into college and, just kind of transitioning into that part of your life as an immigrant.
Right. So, there's a built-in advantage when it comes to being raised by family members who appreciate education or that know what education can do for you in the future. So when I came here, I already had high school education. I went to my science background was really strong, and so I didn't feel I was out of sync with my colleagues that I was going to school with who went to school here. And so I didn't feel, in fact, it was a refuge for me. School was a refuge for me. Although I didn't understand the experiences that the other students went through, I think that was one way that I could become part of this American community that I joined. And it made the whole process a lot easier. But then you can see a student or a child who came here without that sort of background, how intimidating it would be for them to sort of just go to a normal American high school or to even go to college. The families that the different children are coming from in terms of educational background is not the same, right? So if the parents don't understand, the process that it takes. So, for example, I would talk to some parents and they will tell me my child is interested in going to college. And I will say, what year are they? And they will say, he's a junior in high school. And I would say, well, are you thinking about ways to have them, you know, prepare for the SATs and stuff? And they wouldn't know what that means, right? And I can promise you that every student that is in my program or in at the U of R, their parents at some point, or at least most of those parents, know about what the SATs are a lot earlier, right? And so there's a built-in advantage to having a family that understands the process and having that sort of guiding light along the way. And I think that that's what's missing. So although the opportunities are really available and are there for the taking, I think the sort of the guidance that you get from the community and from your family is a lot.
So this is sort of a broader external context maybe for helping people understand the kind of pathways they may have aspirations for the children to follow, but they don't necessarily have the kind of blocks in or an understanding of the blocks in place. Whose responsibility does that fall to, do you think, to sort of provide that that kind of advice?
So I'm not here to assign blame, and I'm not going to do that. Of course, the schools will have to be involved in figuring out that their refugee populations are different than the normal American students that they're getting, and that these backgrounds that they're coming from obviously come with their own challenges. And so they should be actually not only educating the children, but also educating the parents about the process along the way. So the guidance counselors would be really important. And of course, community at large is going to be important, realizing that, you know, so I do community service. We have, you know, a community service program at the U of R called Grassroots Rochester that basically tries to establish some mentoring programs for refugee kids and inner city kids in general. So that those sort of programs might be effective in sort of you know, mediating some of these problems and helping with some of these challenges.
Sure. Ryan, you had a question?
Quickly, and then we'll hear a piece from my colleague Kate O'Connell. But if you could talk a little bit about you shortly after coming to the U.S., you went off to college, and that time period of your life of going off to college is a time when a lot of other people your age are, you know, starting this new chapter in their life, and, you know, you don't really know a lot of people that you go to school with. How much do you think that helped you, you know, kind of assimilate and meet new people and, you know, make friends, the fact that, you know, that first day when you move into college, everyone's new and no one knows their way around or anything like that?
Right. So that's really a good question, because I think partly because this initial confusion that all the 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds were going through was, in a way, just put us on an equal footing, if you would say. And that allowed me to sort of interact with them and help them, because I did a lot of science. I was actually a tutor, and that allowed me to create relationships that eased my resettlement into this society, and I have made a lot of friends, and I think that was part of, so it was very easy and fast for me to become to start seeing myself as an American, although I wasn't a citizen, and I'm still not a citizen. I'm actually going for my interview in a couple of weeks.
We're running short of time, but I just wanted to we haven't got time to hear this full report from our Rochester reporter, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about your experience of one of the things that the reporting that we've done touched on was that here in Rochester, for example, there's a lot of the refugee population are aging, and they're developing, you know, the same kinds of health issues that obviously an aging population in upstate has as well. But there are some particular challenges in getting culturally appropriate care or in navigating some of those kind of language issues, that kind of thing. Do you have any sort of observations or experience about, you know, just that particular kind of dilemma?
Right. And I think you just touched on the biggest sort of one of the biggest elements of that of the issue, which is the language barrier. So with an American patient, you can convey to them the fact that, you know, their blood pressure is being affected by their diet. It's a lot easier. You can talk to them about diets and understand what sort of foods they're eating and what the content of those foods. But when you're talking to an immigrant or someone who comes from a different culture, it's very hard to understand what sort of, what the salt content is, if it's actually an okay food or you should talk to them about it. And then on top of that, you'll have you will have to have a translator in between the doctor, the physician, and the
right,
patient.
Right, so this is another layer.
Another layer of complication that's there.
Right.
And so I know of a couple of, refugee organizations that serve communities. So the Somali community has a community program that they run, and we do sort of health classes for them about blood pressure and diabetes and what these things mean in, and we try to provide so culturally, sort of culturally sensitive classes in that regard. But that sort of training, both from physicians and from these community service organizations, I think is important for dealing with these problems.
And with things like home-assisted care, where we know there's a kind of, there's this, there might be issues of trust, or there might be issues of cultural appropriateness or whatever. I mean, right. Is that does that also present a challenge in terms of getting enough of the community, trained or engaged to be able to provide, services to the community that are appropriate?
And so the cultural context of that is, at least for Somalis from what I know, is because the sort of preventive care we do here, I mean, you go for a yearly physical, I hope,
you caught me up.
Right. And that sort of, preventive care doesn't exist in most countries. And so people actually only go to the doctor when they're sick. And by sick, I mean if there's a wound, gaping wound, you go to a doctor. If you're feeling really dizzy or have... But we don't want them to wait until they're at that point. If a patient's coming to you when they really have a big problem, it's very hard to sort of address the problem.
Right.
And I think that is the cultural context they're coming from. So when you say to a patient that I will be coming to you at your house, but I don't, you don't have any particular problem right now that I see, but this can develop later on. It's hard to convey that message. And then again, right. The language issue comes in. And inviting people into your house is a fraught sort of area when it comes to cultural sensitivity. So I think those are sort of the pieces that sort of inform that can be either an asset or problematic for someone who's trying to provide the service you talk about.
Right. So this is just developing a concept of preventative care, a more holistic version of what healthcare can be is a big challenge.
Right. And explaining to the patients what the aim of this sort of these visits are, and what you're trying to prevent and what you're trying to provide at the same time, and conveying those messages and as clear as possible.
Right. We're just about out of time, Adnan, but just a quick final thought on what can people do, I guess, in terms of processes of engagement from the broader context of the community. Are there things that people can do, to support some of the things that, say, the Somali community is doing in the healthcare area?
Right. So I think it will be very important being aware of the fact that there is a cultural difference, and just having a conversation, just like all humans have conversations, and trying to drop any layering of sensitivity, and just saying what's your preference, what would you want to be done for you, what do you see as your problem, and actually just understanding how they perceive their illness, if there's such a thing, or they perceive their notions of health. I think just getting their definition of that is very important, and then providing then a sensitive care that sort of allays their fears and all of that. I think so from a physician's standpoint, I think that awareness, I think, will solve a lot of the problems that we might have otherwise.
Right. Adnan Hirad, thanks very much for being with us. Adnan's a PhD, medical PhD candidate at University of Rochester, and he's also a member of Rochester's diverse and energetic Somalian community. Been great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Innovation, no worries. Innovation Friday continues after the latest news from NPR. We're going to look at the issue of water pollution, water quality. Does water pollution affect your property prices? The answer is probably. And we're also going to talk about another medical issue, post-polio syndrome. That's all coming up.